You are now plugged into Action Feature.
All right, so here we are with another installment of Action Features, and it's not just James and Mike this time. We have a guest on the show.
Zach Oat from the band Hall & Oates is here.
We couldn't get Hall, but we got Oat.
Yeah.
So we're here to talk about music today. Zach, are you there?
I am here. And the funny thing is, I actually live not too far from Daryl Hall, I'm pretty sure. He has a bar up the street from me.
Really?
Can you get him?
Yeah.
Can you go to the bar?
Do you go in there?
I could try. He might be a better guest. I could probably try and get him.
I doubt that seriously.
Not for our listeners. No. It wouldn't be. You're definitely a better get for us. The guys that listen to this show collect toys and read comics and get upset about movies.
But still, if you could get him,
we'd
take that.
We'll take him.
We'd take that.
We'll take anybody. All right, so we have Zach Oat here, who is the, I'm sorry if I get your title wrong, but I think I got it right, the marketing supervisor for Diamond Select Toys?
That's correct.
All right. So you're here today to talk about all the different Select lines, but we also want to talk to you about your past job that a lot of our listeners might know of, and that was...
I was young, and I needed the money.
Whoa, hey.
We've all seen the film.
Yeah.
it's an old joke, but it probably actually is applicable to that job, although it was also a dream job. We should probably tell them what it is, I guess.
That was, you were editor at editor-in-chief at Toy Fair? Is that...
No, editor-in-chief was oversaw all of the Wizard Entertainment publications.
And that was
Wizard,
Garib.
And... that was Pat McCallum, actually, for a very long time, and later Scott Gramling. I was editor of Toy Fair magazine, which means I oversaw just that magazine. But I worked my way up to that. I started off as just a copy editor, and then I was an associate editor. And along the way, I did some work on other publications because we all kind of shared the same office. So I worked on Anime Insider and In Power. I might have copy edited a little bit. I contributed some stuff to Wizard, but not a whole ton.
Yeah, Toy Fair, to me, is the big one. That's the magazine I remember first picking up and seeing. I saw my first custom figure in Toy Fair magazine, and it blew my mind.
So
I think I saw my first in Wizard magazine, because before Toy Fair existed, they had their Homemade Heroes section. And my brother and I actually entered. We did a Hellboy figure before there were Hellboy figures. We made it out of a Fisto from Masters.
That's cool!
And we actually got in the magazine. And then it was after that that they actually started Toy Fair up.
See, I started with, I think the first custom I figure I saw was in, I think, maybe a Hero Illustrated or something like that.
That's what it was. It was Hero Illustrated.
But I was a reader of Wizard before Toy Fair came along, and I loved Wizard, but I always wanted more of the toy stuff in the magazine. So when Toy Fair came along, I was like, this is it, man. This is the magazine. It was so much better than, and I'm not criticizing those other magazines, but it was so much better than Lee's. It was so much better than Tome Arts. It was just a really fun magazine to read. Every article was insightful, and it gave me information I didn't have, and it was funny.
Yeah, it wasn't treated too seriously.
It was so funny. The Twisted Mego Theater, or Twisted Toy Fair Theater, whatever you want to call it, was so funny. It was such a riot, I would just reread those over and over again. And my dad, who's not really into this stuff, he'll take me to, when I was younger, he would take me to comic shops and toy stores. He would read the magazine. Like, he'd come to my apartment, and when I was still at their house, he would... Anytime I'd have a toy fair, he's like, you got one of those toy magazines? And he would read through the whole issue, and he would be laughing at it. It was just such a great magazine. And I think a lot of the collectors throughout that time period, they would look at Toy Fair as like almost our hunting guide, or the periodical that we would go to and have with us in the car, or where we'd go for our news before the internet and all those different sites started really, really taking off. And everybody went to their... computer for all the news and the articles and all that stuff. That was the magazine, man. More than any other toy magazine, that was the one.
So were you with Toy Fair until the end of Toy Fair?
I actually was not. I wasn't there at the beginning and I wasn't there at the end. I started around it was around issue 30. I had read the first issue back when I was in college, and then I think I got offered a job somewhere around time 27 and 28 had come out, so I was reading those and... Yeah, around 30, and then I don't even know when I ended. It was past 100, it was probably around like 125 or something like that. I'm not sure how far they got. I might have gotten 100 issues under my belt. I was there for about 8 years.
Wow.
1999 to 2011, I think.
Were you there with the format change? Because they went to a bigger size. Were you still around for that?
Yes, I was there for the larger size. Larger size. Oh, I apologize. I was there until 2008, 99 to 2008. And yes, I was there for the bigger size. And then Justin Acklin took over as editor. We'd worked together for many years, and he was there, I think, until it went to digital, a purely digital issue. And I think he oversaw a few of those issues before it. I think it ended, I don't know exactly what number it ended up quitting out at.
So do you feel that that was kind of the culprit for the magazine going away, was the advent of so many toy websites and so many people getting their news from there?
You know, I don't know if... I wasn't privy, I don't think, to actual sales numbers in terms of, like, how many people were actually picking up an issue versus how many people were getting past, you know, skipping us to go to the Internet. The Internet was on the rise. We started having some rivalries with some websites that would, you know, we were trying to break news before the Internet was, like, you know, when with a monthly time, it rarely happened. I think it was primarily the economy had affected a lot of other companies, and so there was a lot of a decrease in advertising, which is, you know, for any magazine that takes advertisements and isn't, you know, isn't purely based on sales to customers, it's a big factor. So, you know, for this kind of stuff we were trying to do, you know, we weren't just doing a magazine through mail order or, you know, and we were getting it. We had to get it to all the different major retailers and, you know, the distributors, and once the advertisers pulled out, that was a lot of our, you know, operating budget.
Yeah.
And of course, all the magazines supported each other. So if any one magazine was doing worse than any other magazines, then, you know, that sort of contributed to it. But you know, I think Inquest might have been actually the first to go. Inquest wasn't doing too well. The gaming magazine. Yeah. They diversified into video games. And I think that actually did lead to some readership problems, but the advertising was, I think, probably the culprit for that as well. It was just a bad time for, you know, everybody, the country. But for advertising is probably the first thing to get cut for any company when they're trying to tighten their budget. You know, if you don't want to, you know, let go staff, then you start looking at how much you're spending outside the company, and that, right. That was just one of the things.
Well, it was a bummer to see it go. I really, truly love the magazine. I think anybody that loves Robot Chicken owes a lot to that magazine. And, I mean, a lot of the guys from that magazine ended up going towards Robot Chicken, too. Didn't you even do some work for Robot Chicken?
You know, I think I'm only in one credit role of the actual series, maybe. But before it was Robot Chicken, it was a web series called Sweet J Presents. I believe it was done for Sony's Screen Blast site, where they were trying to get something going with original content. And it was a lot of the early sketches on Robot Chicken were originally done for Screen Blast, for Sweet J Presents. So I actually was the toy wrangler for that. I ordered and acquired and tracked down a lot of the toys that they needed for that. You know, they did try to work with Migos at first. They ended up going with, you know, other types of bodies. They still needed the clothing. You know, they needed. I worked with customizers to get, like, the custom. Fidel Castro, based on the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer style. I worked, and the custom, you know, adding articulation to Charlie in the Box and stuff like that. I worked with a couple different guys to get that stuff done and sent off to the studios in L.A. I only ever visited once, but I worked, it was about six episodes of that show, and then when they got the Cartoon Network deal, they redid some of the episodes, changed some stuff. Some of the sketches didn't make the cut, and I think I got in the credits for maybe the first episode, just sort of a special thanks, because I sort of did a lot of the pre-work on some of those. But since then, it's been all the guys who used to worry, Twisted Torture Theater, Matt Sinreich, Tom Rook, Doug Goldstein, Mike Fasolo. All of them are still on the show. I can't believe it's still going after all these years.
Oh, I can't either, actually.
More power to them.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows to show how great that idea was and how well executed it was for so long in that magazine that it was able to take on a life of its own and become a television show out of that. But I'll always be thankful to all the guys that made Toy Fair happen, because that really is a staple of those years of collecting for me, was looking forward to that magazine and getting that magazine and enjoying it. So thank you, and thank you to anybody else that made that magazine happen. And I should probably say that if you read Toy Fair and you're wondering which one Zach was, he's the guy with the mutton chops.
Yes.
He's the man with the mutton chops.
I was not the dog. I was not the dog, and I was not the guy who owned the dog. There was a dog named Zach Malamute, and everybody thinks that I had the dog, but the dog was named Zach. I wouldn't own a dog named after myself. So
no.
That was another guy who owned the dog. And he had a dog named Zach before I even came on board. When I got to the office, there was a mug on the shelf that said Zachary. I'm like, oh, did they get me a mug? But no, it was for the dog. The dog didn't even work out of that office. The dog had his own office somewhere else.
And the dog was jealous.
He still had a mug there, I guess, just in case he came by.
There's only room enough for one Zach in this building.
Yeah, the dog's got to go. Yeah.
So it sounds like toys have been a lifelong passion for you. Is that accurate?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I was a child of the 80s.
Right.
I was born in 77. So, you know, I had a bit more personal connection, I guess, than some people, because I grew up in Rhode Island for a big chunk of it, and my dad actually knew a lot of people who worked at Hasbro. He actually interviewed the Hassenfeld brothers.
Okay.
Oh, that's cool.
So I was always getting cool stuff from Transformers and G.I. Joe. I didn't have any of the really big stuff, you know, but I had a pretty good collection of both, and had a big poster of Transformers on my wall for years and years. But I kind of got out of toys like everybody did, and not even into video games. I didn't play a lot of video games as a kid, but I did got back into them in college. It was weird. I would go to, like, KB Toys, like, after a big test, and I'd look at what they had on sale, and, like, for $2.99, I would start collecting, like, Toy Biz figures and discounted 12-inch Star Wars figures. And after school, I ended up working for one of those Hasbro guys who had his own toy company in Newport, Rhode Island, and but then after that, they finally got around to reading my application for a wizard job, and they offered me something at Toy Fair doing copy editing. I'm like, well, that makes a lot of sense. So I took that, and I was there for a while. And I did get out of toys for a little while after Toy Fair. I was working for a movie website called Television Without Pity, doing reviews and stuff. But when the Diamond Select Toys job came along, I jumped at it because I worked with these guys for years, Toy Fair, covering their stuff, going through the showroom at New York Toy Fair, and had a big collection of Mini-Mates, and yeah, I was a big fan of all the stuff they do, and they do so much different stuff. Even back then, they did just so many different things, and they still do even more amazingly different things. It's something different every day.
You know, when we were first talking about doing this, I was like, well, however Zach would be willing to come on the show, we were like, this Diamond does so much stuff that we're going to have to kind of center on just kind of one thing, because if we talked about everything that Diamond does, this show would be 5 hours long. You know, it's just...
Yeah.
So we tried to center on one thing. I wanted to throw in here real quick, though. It's interesting, you grew up in Rhode Island. Both Mike and I grew up here in Cincinnati, so we're Kenner boys.
Yeah, we had Kenner here.
We're on different sides of the growing up on the toy world. But both he and I, you know, grew up here with Kenner, and I think we both would equally say that our dream job would have been to work at Kenner.
Yeah.
Then Kenner got shut down here. Thanks to you, Rhode Island people, and your Hasbro people. So I think this interview is over. So you take the job at Diamond Select. What time was that? What year was that?
That was in, I got my years mixed up. It was in, 2011, I believe. So this year was my fifth San Diego. I started in May of 2011. This is my fifth San Diego Comic-Con with them that was this past year. So, yeah, I didn't work on stuff like Battlestar Galactica. I didn't work on Buffy. You know, this is all back when I was working at Toy Fair. I don't really work on any of it, but I wasn't doing any of the marketing or publicity for those lines. But, you know, the Universal Monsters lines and, all the Mini-Mates stuff, you know, so many different Mini-Mates lines, even just in the past 5 years, different licenses have come and gone. And the big one we're doing now, Nightmare Before Christmas is big for us now, Gotham. Marvel Select's still going strong, and the Ghostbusters line is our big baby right now.
Well, we're going to talk about each line. I do want to say really quick on Mini-Mates, because I don't want to get too far into Mini-Mates, but it is kind of incredible how many Mini-Mates have been done and how many licenses Mini-Mates has covered. That has got to be the line that has covered the most licenses in the most depth of any toy line ever. I mean, that's got to be a correct statement, right?
I wish it was a shorter statement to make because I'd print it everywhere. But it's like it's hard to say what makes Mini-Mates so amazing in like a very short number of words, because it's like it is you think of it as it's a unified scale. It is one toy line, Mini-Mates. They all have the same parts. They're all interchangeable. They're all scale more or less to each other. It's hard to really brag about that. We've tried to brag say, well, do we have the most Marvel characters? I think we still might, Marvel Legends and Marvel Universe maybe giving us a run for our money at this point, but I think we are still up there with the most Marvel characters since we've been making them since 2003. And we just showed Series 70 for the Doctor Strange movie. If you, I guess if you don't count the movie stuff, it might be getting a little closer. But if you count movie stuff, then it's we're up there. In terms of different licenses applied to the same body type, I mean, you know, I don't know if you could, you know, say, well, I mean, you know, do you count Minimates like one line, like you count Marvel Legends, or do you count them like 1/6-inch scale? Because it's not like there's other toy lines that are in scale. It's hard to quantify, but there's definitely been, God, you know, probably over 50, different, you know, nearly 50 or at least or around there, different licenses applied to the Minimates brand.
That's crazy.
You know, and some of them went for, you know, a wave of, you know, 4 2-packs, and some of them went for like 8 waves. You know, we did go pretty deep on Ghostbusters and Minimates. We went into real Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2, and there's still stuff we haven't done, and we may return to that one someday. We're doing the Ghostbusters 2016 stuff. I just found out comes out later on this month. Actually, it might even be next week. We're going to be getting the new movie stuff out. But I mean, Marvel is ridiculous, the number of figures we've done for that. Ghostbusters, Walking Dead, we did a really extensive line based on the comic book. What's the other big one we're working on? Well, Nightmare Before Christmas has been doing really well for us. And the Alien Predator stuff, we're going really deep on that. All three Predator movies, first two Alien movies, we just are about to release our first Alien vehicle, the Alien Minimates APC.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is... I just got a sample of it yesterday. I'm so excited. I'm playing around with it. It's one of our coolest vehicles we've done, and we've done a lot of them. Yeah, no, Minimates is always something new, and the licenses that we've signed in the past, you know, few months that are going to be launching next year are just mind blowing. So I'm excited. I mean, you know, maybe not for everybody. You know, I think for a lot of people, they're going to be like, wow, really? That's big. So we're looking forward to announcing those in the near future. Maybe not at New York Comic Con, but definitely by New York Toy Fair.
You're not going to announce them here.
No.
Right?
He's not going to announce anything here.
Maybe. Well, we recently showed off a couple of lines. We did show off a couple of things. Like we showed like the Vinimates, our larger 4-inch vinyl figures. We showed one off for Beetlejuice, and we are going to do more for that. And we showed one off for Iron Giant. We're going to do more for that. And what was the other one we showed? I can't remember the third license we showed off. I think we did say that we're going to be doing stuff for... I think we're going to do stuff for Vacation, National Lampoon's Vacation. We did show off a Wally World pint glass recently, but I think we're going to try to do Minimates for that.
I saw those in previews, those Wally World glasses. Those are great. Those are very cool.
Yeah, no, that's our real wear. We have this whole line of glasses that are like, you know, if you were in the movie, what kind of glass would you buy from your local, you know, amusement park or restaurant or whatever. So for Gotham, you know, we have like a Fish Mooney's pub glass, and for Back to the Future, we've got a Cafe 80s glass, and just a lot of, or Biff Tannen's Pleasure Paradise. A lot of fun stuff.
I would like to see Clark's eggnog glasses from Christmas Vacation. Remember those things? They had like
The moose, absolutely.
Yeah, the moose.
You know, I never thought about it until recently, but it's probably meant to be a Wally World.
Exactly. I would
callback,
think it was supposed
to be. I meant to go back and I don't know if I actually suggested those to my boss, Chuck Tercera. He does most of the line planning and you know, oversees all the different lines and does a lot of the character selections as well. I don't know if I specifically suggested it to him, but I'm sure it was on his list of ideas. Although I'm not entirely sure that our license is Christmas Vacation based. It may just be
original.
It may just be original, and if they didn't appear in the original movie, that might not be something we can do.
All right, so you were speaking before about how the Minimates, it's kind of the same body and it's shared across all these things. I feel the same way with your Select lines, which is what we're going to talk about mostly here now. I love the fact that you're almost like the new Mego when it comes to those, because it's like all the figures are in scale with each other, for the most part, that I can think of, and all the packaging is similar to each other. So it's a nice way to look at something and go, all these are from the same thing. You know what I mean? The licenses are all different, but this is all one Select line. And you've kept the packaging consistent across them. You've kept the scale somewhat consistent across all of them. And I really enjoy that. And it may have been before you were there that decision was made to make them all the same. Or where did that come from? What was the idea of that? Because you don't see other companies really doing that much, and it's kind of a shame.
It's kind of a mess right now, actually.
Yeah, other companies
switching
where
scales
they
all the time
switch scales, and they've got different packaging all the time for different stuff, and none of their lines look the same towards each other. I really like that you guys keep it consistent, and I'm just curious how that plays in over there.
Thank you for that, by the way, first of all. But I don't know if I can say too much about the origins of the scale, except that the... The line, Marvel Select line, was created in 2002. We had that before we had the Marvel Minimates license, so it's been going for that long. It might be one of the longest running. That and Minimates might both be two of the longest running toy lines ever. I mean, in terms of like how long they lasted, continuously, in terms of continuous production. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Star Wars took a year or two off in between, you know, Return of the Jedi and, you know, Power of the Force 2, whatever you want to call it. But the Marvel Select Scale was originally, they were working with Toy Biz on those, and they were making, you know, they wanted to do something bigger, it was more detailed, higher price point, only for specialty stores. I don't know how the decision to make it 7-inch scale versus 6-inch scale, you know, came about. It's bigger enough to make it a more detailed, but it's not too big that it starts, you know, causing cost problems and packaging problems and display problems. You know, they would work with Toy Biz. I think Toy Biz did a lot of sculpting on it, and then they would just be marketed and sold by Diamond to the comic shops. And after a while, Diamond Select took over that, you know, the character selection and the sculpting. And their license expanded from just the Marvel Knights and Ultimate characters to other, you know, 616 universe characters. Still, I don't know exactly when they were able to get the full range of Marvel characters, but at one point, there was a limited sort of, you know, especially, you know, more secondary characters. That's when you got your Cloak and Daggers and your Watchers and things, and Mephistos and things like that. That's obviously been the continuing strand. So I think it's just basically been, let's keep it in scale to Marvel Select, you know, whenever possible. And the scale to Marvel Select is pretty continuous across the line. You know, there may be the occasional fluke figure where somebody says, well, you shouldn't be that big or you shouldn't be that small. But for the most part, it's pretty continuous, and I think we try to hit that with all the figures just because it's that sweet spot of, you know, detail and size. So, you know, when we did Expendables, when we did Star Trek and Battlestar and all that, there is one discrepancy with Star Trek where some of the Star Trek, the Next Generation figures, I think, are produced at a slightly larger scale than the original series figures. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the only one I can think of. We try to make them. But occasionally one will slip by us. That's a little bit bigger, a little bit smaller, but we try to make them all that 6 feet equals 7 inches.
I think the split in Star Trek happened, too, because our Asylum, I think, was doing the first Classic Treks, and then when you guys took over and Diamond Select was doing them, Diamond Select did the next-gen stuff. And so they did the next-gen stuff at Select scale, but any original series releases, they tried to keep in scale with that older Art Asylum stuff.
Yeah, that might have been it, because that was the first ones that probably needed entirely new tooling. Because the original series, we took over the original series figures after Art Asylum did, I guess, the first series or two, and on their Enterprise stuff and their, what was it, Nemesis line.
Yeah.
So I mean, there was that may have been the first point in time when we were actually using 100% our own tooling. So that may be where the wires got crossed, and it maybe came out a little bit bigger than was intended, but. And once we did that, we stuck with it. There's no going back at that point. So Next Generation is slightly bigger than the original series.
I wouldn't want to mix the two anyway.
Yeah, who needs your Next Gen with your TOS? I want to keep them separated.
Honestly, it seems like if you stand them right next to each other, then if you stand any two figures right next to each other, you can see the differences. But once you put them in any sort of action pose, anything less than an inch in difference, it pretty much goes away.
Right.
Well, I love the fact that you can put all your lines together. And they all look good on the shelf. Because I get frustrated sometimes if I'm making a display and I'm going to put, you know, different lines together. Everything's jumping all over the place. I got a 5-inch figure here and a 6-inch figure here and a 7-inch figure here. The fact that you can put your Ghostbusters figures, your Marvel Select figures, your Gothams, whatever you collect out of all those lines, you can put them on the shelf and it's all consistent. I think that's great. So whoever decided that, hey, let's keep it all consistent, brilliant idea. I'm very happy with all the size staying consistent, all the packaging staying consistent amongst all the lines.
It's been controversial at times because there are some people who see the, you know, some of the packaging, maybe the figure that it comes with and the accessories it comes with don't necessarily fill the packaging. And you know, some people say, well, that's, you know, couldn't you have done a smaller package for that? But it's nice to have it all consistent, and that way when you do the bigger packaging, you can, you know, put something big and a nice big accessory in there for another figure that maybe needs it. And it was also, you know, some people were not sure what we were going to be doing with the Muppets Select line. And, you know, I tried to say repeatedly, this is going to be in scale to our Select action figures. And I would say it was a 7-inch scale. But for a lot of people, they weren't really fully understanding that, because some people would refer to the Palisades line as being a certain scale. And I don't really know even how they arrived at that, because I don't know if there really is an average height for a Muppet.
Yeah.
And I don't think they were basing them on human heights, the scale they're talking about. So when I would say 7-inch scale, I think a lot of people were imagining that our figures would be bigger, but I was trying to say they were in scale to our 7-inch figures. I tried to say that in conversation as well, you know, with all the information they needed, but a lot of people were surprised when they came out how small they were. But if you put them next to a select action figure, that's how big the Muppets are in real life. Well, real life.
Well, there are real life puppets.
Yeah.
And
yes.
And they have interactions with
people.
Right.
Yeah. So,
yeah. I mean, you know, they cheated. They cheated all in the movies and TV shows anyway. I just had a conversation on the forums about it, where, you know, they say that Muppets are certain heights, and there's actually an official list of heights from the movie. But when you see them on screen talking to other humans, they're, you know, they're almost at eye level with each other, even though they are so much smaller. And it's just funny to see, you know, what, even though there's this printed list of official heights, that they'll shoot it the way it's the funniest or it looks the best, and that's obviously the way you want to go. But we try to be consistent with previous depictions of the characters.
Since we're speaking on the Muppets line right now, you talked about how the people that love the Palisades line. I can try to think of different toy lines over the time, and I think that the Palisades Muppets line has like one of the most devoted fan bases I've seen for a toy line. Like, they're serious about that line. Like, if you collected it, you were full in, and you talk about how great that line is, and it's always at the top of their top 10 toy lists and all those things. Is it a bit intimidating to go into that license with that kind of background of the previous line?
You know, it was something that I think Chuck wrestled with a lot. You know, how was he going to, you know, there hadn't been anything on the market in a while. I think he knew that there would be a fan base for it. But how to make it, how to approach it so that it was different enough from the, you know, Palisades line to, so that it wouldn't invite direct comparison. I mean, it's absolutely been directly compared, you know, from day one, but it's, you know, making it select scale was obviously a big thing. Choosing to go with more articulation versus, you know, versus less, which the Palisades line was great. I had all of them, but, you know, they weren't necessarily the most poseable. Elbows were rare on certain figures. If there was a lot of texture on the fur, like Fozzie, or if they were very thin, like Kermit, you know, then articulation was not, you know, they wouldn't go that route. But Chuck has tried to make all the figures, you know, fully articulated, and we found a way to make it work. And I think nowadays most people prefer that. Most people prefer to have more articulation than less. People are always comparing our old Marvel Select figures, which, you know, did have less articulation, to the new ones, which have slightly more, and on a more consistent basis.
Sorry, the key is the way it's hidden.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at early Marvel Legends from Toy Biz, and looking back, those look like junk to me.
They get to the point where the body looks robotic. You know, where they
losing some of the sculpt, and, you know, seeing what you guys are doing now and putting out, finding a good balance of hidden. I'm thinking about the Ghostbusters.
They're
comes to mind.
Perfect when it comes to that.
Fantastic.
I remember when jumping over to Marvel Select, when the change was kind of made from those sculpted. You know, where they were more pre-posed a little bit, and the articulation didn't seem as integral, like it wasn't the driving force of the figure. And when you guys started switching more articulation, I think it was the Wolverine figure that really clued me in, like that classic blue and yellow Wolverine. I looked at that and I was like, that's a great sculpt, and that's some really good, well-hidden articulation on that. This may be the best Wolverine I've ever bought. And that's when I started noticing more and more of your guys' stuff was like, okay, wow, they're really hitting it right, where it's, this sculpt is really good. And this articulation's really well done and really well hidden. And so it was a nice change to see in that. And I wonder how much of that, I mean, you may not have been there when that change was being made, but I wonder how much of it was that you guys really wanted to do that from the start and the license was so limiting that it was like, okay, well, we got to just bide our time until we can start doing more articulation on these things and kind of catching up to what the public's wanting.
I think at the time, at the beginning, you know, McFarlane Toys was the king of collector action figures, and they did a lot of stuff that had zero articulation, but most of it had very limited. So I think the thought was that articulation was not as important, and also it differentiated us from, you know, Marvel Legends, which was all about the articulation. From the beginning, Chuck has not wanted to, and I'm speaking from what I understand of his philosophy on figures, which is that he doesn't like to see a nice sculpt broken up by a lot of articulation.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is why he tries to make it as hidden as possible, working with, you know, sculptors like Gene St. Jean and Gentle Giant and various others. And, you know, having it hidden and having it not be visible is number one. If you can't hide it, then, you know, like say on Silver Surfer, you know, to put an articulation joint into his, his torso would be incredibly noticeable. So, you know, he's got a solid torso in that case, but, you know, then he's got a, you know, full articulation of his arms and legs. And even when you have the articulation of the arms and legs, if you cut in enough space to make, you know, I've seen some, you know, revolutionary new ways to do articulation, but the traditional methods, if you want to have a full range, like where you can double that arm back, you have to cut away so much that the figure does begin to look a little bit lanky or thin, or like there's pieces of him missing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, having the full mass of the figure, you know, so that when he's standing at rest, he looks normal, you maybe have to sacrifice a little bit of range on some of the articulation points, but that's just how it has to be. It's a toy. It's not, you know, soft flesh. It's hard plastic. Yeah. So it's just, you know, the sacrifice you have to make to make a really good-looking figure. You really do have to choose, in a lot of times, posability versus articulation. There are some, you know, figure lines that, due to their nature, they can go, you know, they can have their cake and eat it too, but it's very difficult.
Since we're still on the topic of Marvel here, with the Marvel line, as opposed to the other lines you guys have going, you have, say, for, you know, there's Ghostbusters figures, and you guys are pretty much the only game in town for classic Ghostbusters figures. As Muppets, you're the only game in town right now for classic Ghostbusters figures. For Marvel, though, you've got Marvel Legends out there, and you've got Marvel Universe out there that are also doing figures. And does that play into the character selection at all, that watching what they're doing and seeing, you know, what kind of needs to be fulfilled? Like, for example, that Watcher figure. I don't think Hasbro's ever tackled, or Toy Biz ever tackled, the Watcher. Do those things play into your character choices? Like, okay, we could do this guy and this guy that haven't been really touched in these other lines, and thanks to our larger scale thing, we can kind of make it work. Or does it really just stay to its own thing, and you don't really look at those other things too much?
I think the line has changed a lot. You know, we the contract, obviously, after 2002, after 14 years, you know, there have been a couple different, you know, modifications to what characters are available to us. So maybe at one time, you know, when we didn't have, when we weren't, you know, we didn't necessarily have rights to make a Hulk figure, you know, making a character that Marvel Legends had never done and that might potentially work with Marvel Legends, you know, was good. Something that we saw need, you know, we saw we could piggyback onto it, especially in the early days when there weren't a lot of Marvel Selects out there. But nowadays, you know, Marvel Select is on its own. There's well over 100 figures in the line, and it's you know, there's a Marvel Select fan base. People collect Marvel Select and nothing else, or, you know, at least nothing else Marvel. I think that's something where we look at each figure and say, well, who deserves a figure, who needs a figure, who have we done, who haven't we done? You know, there are certain characters we have done that we don't see a need to revisit, at least not in the comic style. Movie style, you know, we'll go back. If it's important to the movie, then we'll revisit it. But in terms of, like, comic characters, you know, we look at, you know, is it time to do a big character? We haven't done one in a while. Is it time to do a female character? We haven't done one in a little while. So, you know, we just announced Destroyer, and we do have a female figure we're going to be announcing fairly soon. I'm not entirely sure when. I'm hoping it'll be at New York Comic Con, but I really don't know. I think she'll be very exciting when we show her, because I think she's actually a character that Marvel Legends has not done, which is rare nowadays.
But, well, that's exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be in scale to Marvel Select, but like I said, you know, if it's less than an inch, you can probably cheat it with a cool pose, and I know a lot of people do, especially if it's something where they prefer our figure to something that Marvel Legends did, and, you know, they also cheat to get, you know, Legends in their Select displays. But for the most part, it's we're still in the minority, just because we do limited editions. There are set numbers of figures. Sometimes we'll revisit something if there's, like, a significant higher demand for it, but.
Like
the characters
Deadpool.
We do are, what's that?
Like that Deadpool. I help out at my comic shop on Wednesdays, and I can't tell you how many full cases of that Deadpool figure we have gotten over the years. It's crazy how many of those Deadpool figures we've ordered.
He's still our, you know, one of our most popular top selling figures. I mean, it's him and the Incredible Hulk, really, the original Green Hulk, the big you know, gamma rated monster we did. But Deadpool is definitely one of our top sellers. You know, people ask when we, you know, do a new one, but we don't see a need to do one because, you know, people love the one we did. So,
yeah, it's an all-around, you know, great Deadpool. There's really no reason to revisit it.
But it's character selection is tough. It's tough. Sometimes there's characters that, you know, we can't necessarily do at a certain time, just in terms of where it lines up with movie promotions. But, you know, we keep going back and we hear what fans ask for, and I think we listen. Chuck loves the movie stuff. He always says that he'd just do the movie stuff if he had a choice. Not that he doesn't love comics, but, you know, the movie universe is so rich and deep, and, you know, we don't get to make half of, you know, what we want to, because we want to save space for the comic guys. And I'm always saying, I hear the fans asking for the comic one, so we know there's a market out there, and we know that there's fans who want more. And, you know, we started something, we feel the need to keep it going. So hopefully people like what we continue to put out. We try to find a balance, because we can only make so many figures a year, and we try to find a balance between, comic and movie. Some people say, well, why don't you just make it into two lines? It's the same, it's, you know, two lines is still the same number of figures. So we make, you know, we try to make a balance between comic and movie every year.
So,
and Disney Store helps out with that a lot, because when the Disney Store gets involved, we can make more.
So when a movie is out, are you saying basically that you have to hold off on doing it? Because you just put out a Steve Rogers, Captain America, I think, but the movie's been out.
Coming one, of it too. Well, they released the three for Civil War, like the Captain America, the Iron Man, and the Winter Soldier, and now there's another version of Cap coming soon with the unhelmeted head.
So were those in conjunction with the film, or... I mean, do you have to...
The three Civil War figures that we did were... Obviously, we're all Civil War based, and we did this other one. After that, we were able to get an exclusive for Disney Store with the unmasked head, and so a different base. Some people wanted to have an extra end piece for the diorama to make it look like one we've shown at shows before. There are only three figures, so we were only able to do three pieces for them, but we've got a fourth piece that we put in with the unmasked Cap. So when people can get that at the Disney Store and have a full... a symmetrical diorama, which I think was making people a little crazy. So that's another way, that's a way we were able to get that piece out there. But we did do a comic Captain America not too long ago for Disney Store, which is still there as an exclusive. It's, I think we're calling it Avenging Captain America, I'm not entirely sure. But it's based on, I think it's based on a specific miniseries. It's meant to be sort of a World War II costume, but he has more of a streamlined helmet. And it's, it came out pretty cool. He has a Hydra base behind him. Everybody thought that was our hint about his change in allegiance from recent issues, but it was absolutely not. But yeah, no. I think Captain America is one of those characters that there is no, you know, they try not to. They don't have any sort of qualms about people maybe not knowing what Captain America is supposed to look like. I think it's just with certain characters where he's going to be in a movie, you know, maybe they want to promote the movie look versus the comic look. So you know, we just won't do a comic figure that month or that year.
Okay.
But we can still revisit in the future.
Okay, that's what I was asking, because it seemed like there would be conflict with Hasbro, or at least I don't know how the licenses are worked out, but with the price points, I mean, I would buy a Diamond Select figure every time.
Definitely.
over a Hasbro.
Prices used to be a lot more different, but they've gotten a little closer over.
Yeah, I mean, their price keeps going up.
And yours has stayed pretty consistently right around that $25 mark in most places that I see.
Plus, we try not to raise prices. We try not to raise prices unless we absolutely have to.
Right.
Have you, now with like Ghostbusters, you were saying before about trying to get so many comic figures and so many movie figures out. With Ghostbusters, we get an entire wave at once where you get three figures all in a wave. Has it ever been, I don't remember a time where Marvel Select was doing that, where you would get an entire wave, like three different figures all in one case coming at the same time. Is that?
No, they at one point they were doing best of assortments where they would offer three, I think, previously released characters in a new production run, plus maybe a fourth variant figure that had not been done before. So, like, we did, gosh, I want to say one of the Spider-Women. Maybe not Jessica Drew, because she, well, not Jessica Drew was Spider-Woman, because that was a con exclusive, I believe, but Jessica Drew was Arachne. That was, I believe, first offered in an assortment with, like, Red Hulk and another character. So we did like a best of Marvel Select assortment. I think we did three or four of them. And there were some characters who made their debuts in those assortments, but for the most part it's been one at a time.
Single figures. Now is that just a matter of resources, like, or is that a decision so much to like, okay, let's just put out that one figure? And
I think when they started out, they were trying to make it like a monthly thing, try to have a new figure every month. And I think they eventually settled, you know, got to a point where it was, you know, nine a year was good for them, eight or nine. But I think it's just eight or nine single releases a year versus
three per quarter or something.
Versus three per quarter. Yeah, I mean, it's really apples and oranges. We could do Ghostbusters. It's just, I think, with Ghostbusters versus Marvel. Again, Marvel was just how it started out. I think we just continued over the years. It works for us, so why mess with perfection?
Yeah,
but for Ghostbusters, I think it's just a question of if you want to make characters in Ghostbusters who are not necessarily single, strong, standalone characters, you want to include them in an assortment.
I get you.
So, I mean, if we said this month it's Lewis Tully, and people said, well, you know, maybe I don't need Lewis Tully. But if we sell them in an assortment, you know, and people can put up on the pegs Lewis Tully, Peter Venkman, and Egon, or Ray Winston in that case, then it may find more customers and more fans, and, well, more so that the retailers are more willing to take a risk on the character. And you know, we want retailers to be comfortable with with what we're putting out. So if they don't have confidence in a character, but they have confidence in assortment, then that's we have an opportunity to do more obscure characters. Which is why, you know, we get a lot of requests for obscure Marvel Select characters. And we, you know, since the days of you know, Mephisto and the Watcher, you know, we try to be a little bit, we have become a little bit more conservative. Because in their day, Mephisto and Watcher were not necessarily huge sellers. They were, you know, I've heard stories of people saying, yeah, we had so many unsold Mephistos back in the day that we were, like, you know, playing hockey with them behind the store.
And which is
like,
crazy.
And it's crazy because now it's like a highly sought after figure. So it's like, you know, if you want a Mephisto, good luck.
Same with the Watcher, you know, I'll bet. He's got to be. Because both of those are figures that Marvel Legends never tackled, and they're changeable size, basically. Like, you know, those are kind of larger characters in the comics. So they work great with every line. So it's crazy to think that those were not good sellers.
It boggles my mind back in the day, too. But I guess it was, you know, it may have just been a case of supply and demand. Marvel Legends was big, but maybe not as big as it's gotten. And Marvel Select was obviously not as far along as it is now. And there weren't as many collectors of the line. But we do, you know, we do try to put out characters that maybe aren't necessarily on, you know, the top of people's lists every now and again. Like, Destroyer was not something where necessarily we'd gotten a ton of requests for it, but we'd gotten enough, and we also knew this character we wanted to do, and we knew that we hadn't done any really good Thor villains, and it was just a character that we thought would work well for Select, so, and we thought we could do well with it, so that was that. I mean, you know, we could have done another Cap or an Iron Man, but we wanted to get a character out that maybe had not been done properly, because there have been Destroyers, but the Marvel Legends Destroyer was a long time ago, and the movie Destroyer was, I think, fairly limited in posability that they did. So, you know, if we're able to give the first super, you know, larger scale, you know, fully posable Destroyer figure, then I think Chuck likes to be first with stuff. I think that's why, that may be one of the reasons why the female figure we're doing got made the cut, because I didn't even realize when I heard that we were doing her until I looked it up when I realized Marvel Legends had made her. So I was pretty surprised at that, actually. She's a pretty major character.
Well, now I'm curious.
Yeah, I really want to know who that character is.
If I told you, I would. Chuck would be furious. But I'm hoping we'll be revealing it in New York Comic Con next month. Don't
you can just, like,
that.
Spell it. And then you're not telling us. Just give us all the letters that are in the name.
The only thing that keeps us from showing it is sculpt and paint. So I've seen the final sculpt, I think. So at this point, it's just seeing the paint. I don't even know if we need to. We probably have to show it to Marvel, make sure they're cool with it before we show it to anybody else. But you know, it's once something's done, we tend to show it because, you know, every month we have previews and we put new stuff in there. And once it's done, we ship it. You know, we ship it from the factory and we ship. You know, once the manufacturer's done, we ship it from the factory to the warehouse and we ship it from the warehouse to the on the next truck to the comic shop. So any if you don't have a figure, it's because something's being worked on it or something's being approved or something. We're not just sitting around doing nothing. It's I don't know about that, but it's you know, we're constantly working, and we do have a lot of different lines we work on, but everything's moving at some speed or another.
You talked about approval. Now, as far as likeness approval goes, I know there's some licenses that the likeness is included, but there are some that you have to actually go to the actor or the actress and get likeness approval. Is that something that you guys have to do with any of your lines?
I think there's two things there. There's likeness rights and likeness approval. You may not have the right to make a figure of a character, of an actor, if the studio doesn't, you know, have those rights. You'd have to go and negotiate those rights separately. But a studio may have the rights, and they may not need to get approval from the actor, which is, I think, rare, or they do have to get approval from the actor, which means that we would show, you know, our sculpt to the actor. And then, you know, when you're going after the likeness rights separately, then you obviously approval is definitely happening. The studio would approve it regardless, has to approve it regardless. But you know, there are cases when you do need to go to the talent, and some cases where you don't. But I think in most cases you do need to go to the talent. And you know, some actors are great to work with, and some actors, you know, are busy or, you know, aren't used to it. Maybe they aren't used to the whole process of getting toy made, or maybe they're overused to it. So maybe they have very specific requests. Maybe they're pretty easy going. It can vary, but we do. I think, you know, for instance, Universal Monsters, there were certain character actors whose likenesses were included in Universal Monsters license. So we could make, you know, Glenn Strange or whatever. But we did go after getting the likeness rights to Lon Chaney Jr. because those were not included. So we had to go and get the rights, like the license, to make figures based on Lon Chaney Jr.'s likeness, and then, you know, they would approve that. His estate would approve it.
You ever have anything fall through because of an actor not signing off on something?
You don't have to name names. Just,
yeah, you don't have to say anything. Yeah. It is, but.
No, it's definitely happened. It's definitely happened. We've been pretty lucky for the most part that people see our stuff and they like what we're doing. But there's definitely been a couple things that have not gone through because of, you know, whatever reasons.
Yeah.
But you know, it can happen with anything. There could be problems with on any end of anything. So it's you know, it's definitely happened, but it's thankfully very isolated.
Speaking about some other lines here, you have the Star Trek Select line, and that one's a bit different than the other Select lines in that I feel those characters may be a little more static than the other lines, and it's, you know, more differentiating from the Star Trek figures that came before them.
It's definitely the most different from early figures, and it's different from, I think, anything else we're doing now. We did so many articulated Star Trek figures for so many years that when we looked to bring it back, after, you know, not having a lot of interest from retailers in some of the last stuff, things we offered, there were a lot of figures that never made it to stores because...
still breaks my heart.
Interest was low. And again, it was the economy, probably. And also the show, had been, TV shows had been off the air for a little while, so there wasn't necessarily a lot of, you know, Trek in the air. We wanted to do something different, so we decided to go with interchangeable parts route. And, you know, articulation varies on the different characters. Some have, you know, a certain number of rotation points. Some have fewer, some have more. And there are hinges on some of them. But Kirk and Spock, you know, they have interchangeable legs. You can have them jumping, kicking, standing, kneeling. Picard, he had fewer interchangeable parts, but he did also come with, like, a larger diorama thing, the Borg torso. Worf, a lot of interchangeable parts, including interchangeable head, and we're working on now the Khan, which has interchangeable heads, arms, legs, everything, and he comes with a command chair for the Reliant, which is very cool. And we recently announced we're working on a Borg, and the designs I've seen for it look amazing. I don't know if I've seen any sculpting for it yet, but you know, we weren't able to do a full wave of Borg back when the line was on its way out, the articulated line, but this one should be very cool, and I think we're, you know, trying to include a nice balance of our articulation and interchangeability.
As a personal note for the Star Trek stuff, I really did love the more articulated stuff, and I still like these new ones, but is there ever a chance that we'll see this line evolve, like the Marvel Select line did, to start adapting more articulation in now that we're kind of more distanced from that time?
I think it's constantly evolving. I mean, obviously, you know, the figure releases are far apart, even farther apart than Marvel Select. You know, one at a time, but I think it might be almost a year since Worf came out, just because we've been, we showed Khan prototype in February at New York Toy Fair. It's been just a little bit slow going, but, you know, they want to get it right, and, you know, they're having other things that have maybe temporarily detoured us, you know, onto other lines that maybe were a little bit more work intensive. But Khan is definitely coming by the end of the year, and the Borg is, I believe, being sculpted. And like I said, the Borg, I think, will have a little bit more articulation. Khan, I think, maybe not so much. I think he'll be more like Worf in terms of, like, static, but he does have a lot of parts. And one thing I like to say is that the articulation on the Star Trek figures, you know, there's a lot of it, and it was fairly functional, but those were never superposable figures. They were never,
that's
like,
true.
You know,
that is true.
Ones that were going to, you know, take a knee and, you know, and take a firing pose and, you know, lunge at an opponent or anything like that. And I think this new line, Star Trek Select line, lets you do a lot of stuff that you wouldn't be able to do even with a fairly posable figure. I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of things that you wouldn't be able to do that with these parts you can do. I think that there's something to be said for that. As you know, as a longtime collector, I know that people do like to have posability. I love to have posability. I used to, you know, go nuts every time something was really highly posable, and that makes them fun to play with just in your hands, you know. But I think there's a lot of display. There's a lot of displaying going on in especially in the Star Trek community, and I think there's a lot of people who do just put their figures up on the shelf and just leave them there. And I think that's definitely something that is what we were thinking about when we did this. But that said, I think, you know, there were conversations recently about, you know, what should be articulated on the Borg, and I think that we're erring on the side of, you know, more articulation. So we'll see how that one comes out. There are certain cost aspects that we need to take into consideration as well.
Well, the thing is, too, that you guys, and I'm saying this even though I've just said the other thing, that you have done the Khan, and you've done, you know, Kirk, and you've done Spock, and so those figures still exist in articulated forms. If somebody really wanted an articulated figure, you could get on eBay, you could do this. So it is nice that you're not just repeating the same things, and you are trying something different with the license.
That's true. Those characters do exist.
They're
Borg
still
will be
out
the
there.
First one that... the Borg will be the person that doesn't
exactly
exist.
Yeah.
So that'll be, I guess, the real test, whether people who don't have a Borg in their collection. I mean, we did some alien Borgs, which are pretty cool, but I don't think we ever released any human Borgs in that scale. So that'll be the real test about, you know, whether people are willing to take the plunge on that, and hopefully that shows people that, you know, interchangeability can be fun too.
Yeah.
You know, it's to each their own. I totally understand the stance some people have on articulation versus interchangeability.
I wanted to say a personal thank you too. Back when you first started at Diamond Select, you probably don't remember this, but I run this site, apcaction.net. It's a Star Trek review site, and I haven't done much with it in a while, but I was doing a panel on Star Trek collectibles at a Creation Star Trek convention, and I contacted you, and I said, hey, you know, I'm going to have this panel, and it would be nice to have some giveaways, and you sent me so much stuff, it was incredible. You sent me, like, multiple Enterprises and phasers and all this stuff, and you got it out to me so fast.
It was a Star Trek Christmas.
It was crazy. It was this humongous box. And I took it to that show, and I had a really successful, fun panel, and I gave away all the stuff during the panel for trivia contest, and there were so many people that came up to me during that show, and they said, you know, we spent all our money getting into the show and paying for the autographs that we didn't have anything to come home with, and so this panel and these goodies and these giveaways really are the take-homes, and just want to say thank you for doing that. And that was all you, man. Like, you, had it not been for you sending that stuff to me and being so generous and kind, that would not have been a success. So, thank you. That was very, very nice of you. And I thank you, I think, through email, but it's I still think about it. Like, man, this guy didn't have to do this. And no other guy at any other toy company has ever done anything like that for me. So it was just really awesome. And I just wanted to say personally thanks, since I have
you. You're welcome. I know the site. I don't think I put together that you were the guy from Piece of the Action. So that's awesome. I vaguely remember this, that I did something with Piece of the Action a long time ago. And I hadn't had a lot of contact with the site recently, but now I'm in contact with the site again. That's fantastic.
There you
go. Is Piece of the Action still active?
It's still there. I haven't reviewed in a long time, just because I was doing reviews every single day there, and it just became too much. Like, I just needed a break and to walk away from it for a while. But there's so much new Star Trek stuff coming out that I'm thinking about maybe starting to back up again. But maybe I'll pick up a select figure.
No, if there's anything you want to review on PC Action, definitely draw me a line. No, I'm a fan of the site, like I said. So happy to do it. Chuck is always cool about letting me send stuff off to shows and panels and, you know, where people are representing. You know, I've been working with some of the Ghostbusters groups who have been at different shows. So, like, I sent some stuff to the Proton Charging, the Proton Surge at Gen Con, and I sent some stuff to the Mass Hysteria event at San Diego, and there's some Massachusetts guys who've been taking our stuff to Boston Comic Con, and they're great. The Ghostbusters guys are really great. It's great to work with people who are, you know, passionate about the stuff that we make, and we want to say thanks to the people who helped keep the line going, this company going, really, since 1999. The company's been around since.
Well, there's a ton of other lines that we have written down here we want to talk about, but we're already getting close to an hour, and my favorite line, and Mike's favorite line that you guys do, is Ghostbusters. So we're going to kind of maybe do a part two with you eventually, but we want to talk about Ghostbusters.
Sure, yeah.
And your interaction online with Ghostbusters is, like, I'm on the GBFans.com forums,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that you come on there and you're constantly talking with people on there and responding to questions, and, you know, when the line was first shown, there was a lot of fans who were like, hey, you've got the lifeguards on the belts, and it would be great if you didn't have those, because that's from Ghostbusters 2. And, you know, we see that they're ungloved. It would be nice if there was a way to do gloved. And you were responding to all that stuff, and it made changes in those figures right out the gate. Like, it was incredible to watch that interaction, where it's like, oh, okay, yeah, so the lifeguards, we should try and take those off. We'll try and take those off. You guys want to try and do, you know, get gloved hands, we're going to try and make it happen. And it did happen. Like, it was, you don't see that interaction with a lot of other companies. Like, if Hasbro were to put on a Marvel Legend and show it, I don't know if the response would be the same, that people would say this, 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 and this, and Hasbro would jump on a forum and go, okay, we're going to do our best to correct it and make it better, and by the time it actually hits the stores, it is better. So that's pretty amazing.
All credit goes to the fans who pointed that out, really. I mean, I do spend probably too much time on message boards, you know, Chuck wants everything to be, you know, just right. He doesn't want a product that's not accurate. So if it's something we can catch early on, you know, and something he's passionate about, like the Ghostbusters line, then, you know, he wants to fix it. So, you know, we were able to get the black gloved hands in there, and we were able to get the lifeguards off. There's some people who are like, hey, where are the lifeguards now? But it's not accurate. And some people, you know, weren't happy that we, the hand, you know, the that you know the gloves aren't exactly, you know, what they as glovy as they'd like. But it's, you know, it was that or nothing. So at that point, so we, you know, we tried to make the changes that we can to make it as accurate as possible. But the guys who pointed out, you know, that's what it is. If we can catch it and fix it, then that's great. Not that we never make any mistakes. You know, we try to catch them, try to get them right the first time. But if we can fix something, you know, beforehand, and, you know, the tooling stage, then that's, once the tooling's done, then, it, you know, it's pretty much set. But if we can fix it, then we'll try.
I review YouTube channel with my sons, and when we reviewed those Ghostbusters, I mentioned that with you could see it was just the same hands painted black. And there were some people complaining about that, but I'm like, that's a silly thing to complain about. If you're getting an extra, you don't have to comment on this, Zach, because I know you. It's, you know, you don't want to say anything negative towards any fans, but I'll say it. It's a ridiculous thing to complain about. If you're getting an extra thing in the figure that wasn't there before, that gives you an option, don't complain about it.
They may not have been privy to that whole, you know, online conversation and what was shown before and what wasn't shown and whether they were originally intended to have them and whether it was a last-minute addition. I mean, I understand, you know, if it was something we planned from the beginning, maybe we would have done it differently. But, you know, it was something that we tried to make work with what we had. And I think honestly, I don't even think I think they look pretty glovy myself. But
me too.
But it's, you know, it's everybody, every fan base, you know, has their diehard fans, people who look at stuff and look at the detail and say, well, this is not right and this is not right and this is not right. And, you know, in this case, they helped us fix something. But there are some cases where, you know, you have to accept the limitations of toys and the manufacturing, the, you know, the level of detail we can get, the level of, you know, a consistency across mass production. And it's, you know, we try to offer a fairly low priced item, you know, for what we're offering, you know, across the board. But there's some people who think that for what they're paying, they should get another, you know, maybe something more than what they've gotten. And that's absolutely their right to say so. And we try to give them something that they think that people find to be worth the money. Better yet, a bargain. And I think in most cases we try to do that. And there are people who are always going to want a little bit something more, and that's fine with them. You know, we understand that, you know, we can't necessarily be all things to all people.
That is true. But I can remember a time probably 10 years ago, James and I were sitting around talking about this Ghostbusters line, basically what you guys have put out as a dream line. Like, we were wishing for it.
Yeah, this is the holy grail for us.
And it was just a pipe dream. We fully believed that it would never happen, and so you guys have done it. I mean, you've put them out. So
the Mattel line was fine for what it was.
It was okay.
It was okay. You know, you had to order them online. There was a lot of body reuse. You didn't get things like interchangeable gloves and a lot of this. You know, the secondary characters that we're going to get from you guys. We didn't get the dioramas. We didn't get all those other things. So it was a fun line, but it's still not what I wanted. Like, I was thinking in my head, like, what this line could be. The minute I saw these figures, like, this is what I wanted. This is the Ghostbusters line that I've always wanted.
The sculpts are a little bit more serious. I mean, I don't want to say they're better sculpts, but they're less toy-like and more like, these are real people that acted in a movie.
Yeah.
They're very serious, if I can use the word serious for toys. They have very serious sculpts.
Well, the Mattel line overall felt more like it was a toy line that was made for kids but somehow sold towards adults.
Right.
Whereas this one feels very much like it's an adult collector line.
Right.
The build a diorama, that's probably the largest thing I think you guys have ever planned out and done. Was that a driving force when the line first started, or it was very much like, sort of, okay, we're going to do the Ghostbusters license, we're going to do these figures, and then you started looking for a build-a-concept, or was that kind of right in the beginning to go, let's build a rooftop?
I think that was pretty much Chuck's idea from the beginning. Whether he thought he'd be able to make it work, I think was up in the air, and there was a long time we were trying to figure out how many figures we actually need to make the diorama happen. But from the very planning stages, you know, we started off with 12 figures, and then at some point we realized that we were going to have to go to 15. So there were certain characters that maybe wouldn't have been done if not for the fact that we actually needed to add three more figures just to get all those parts costed out and fit them into, you know, 15 different packages. So I think that was where some of the ghosts came in. They were later additions to the line. But at one point there were going to be 12, and some of the early promotional material says 12. I think even some of the early packaging says 12.
Yeah, the first wave says 12 on the back.
Yeah, but now it's 15. So, it's just the size of the thing was actually even, we knew it was big, but it was even bigger than we thought.
Yeah, from what I have so far, it's already like an impressive display. I can only imagine when I have all 15 figures what it's going to look like. Now, it's bigger than all the other stuff you've done before. Now, is that making you look at other build-a-figure concepts for the other select lines and going, well, we've gone this big. Can we go this big with something else with a different line, or even with a, maybe a future Ghostbusters line? Or is it, have you looking at other Build-A-Figure concepts and seeing, you know, the success of this and where it's going and where you could take it to other licenses?
I think we've looked at what other big things we can do, either for, you know, for other lines, or even for this line, if that happens. You know, we've got some larger dioramas. The Gotham line we keep building onto. You know, it's not necessarily a complete project where you have to get, you know, so many pieces to make it work, but we, you know, we try to expand the diorama we've done there. We're going to eventually be, you know, publicizing our Kill Bill and Pulp Fiction line, which is about 21 figures long, and there will be some buildable dioramas in that as well. Some only, you know, a couple pieces, but some more than that. So hopefully that's something that people are going to like when we find. Well, I know people are interested in it because I get questions about it every day, but when we finally show it, hopefully something that people are going
to
dig.
That's something we wanted to talk about, but we'll save that for another installment because we're running low on time here. Just to finish off Ghostbusters, what all does the license cover? We've only got two waves left of the first Ghostbusters. Is Ghostbusters 2 on the table? Is the real Ghostbusters cartoon on the table? Are those things that could be explored? I'm not saying that you're definitely thinking about them. I'm just saying, are they possibilities?
I think everything is on the table still. Nothing's been locked down, but we're definitely looking at what we could do after this. I think it's done well for us, and I think it's something that we want to stay in this Ghostbusters world. So we're gonna see what could come next. I don't think it's gonna be Ghostbusters 1, but we'll take a look at what's out there and what we can do and what we can build, and hopefully people like what we come up with.
I'd be completely fine with a build of Ecto-1 that just sits there. Yeah. Doesn't have to move. Just sits there and is the right scale. I'm just throwing that out there. That'd be fine with me.
That'd be awesome.
Vehicles are tough already. I don't even know how a build a vehicle would necessarily work, but it's certainly, you know, like I said, anything's on the table.
Speaking of things on the table, one final question. Do you have any dream licenses that you want to pick up and work on? Put out? Something you really want?
Gosh, you know. Yeah. Every now and then I'm like, oh, I should remember that next time somebody asks me this question. At one point it was like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, just because it was like my favorite movie when I was a kid. But gosh, I don't know. Watching the new Tick TV series on Amazon was I watched the pilot for the new series, and it was very entertaining and made me think a lot about the old Tick and how that one line they did wasn't so great. You know, more Tick toys.
Yeah.
But it's you know, there's a lot of stuff out there. I'd love to see Mad Max toy line really done.
Yes,
right.
That'd be great.
You know, and N2 Toys had so many great licenses. N2, then later WB Toy had so many great licenses. But you know, I think the execution could be brought up to modern times in a lot of them.
Definitely.
And there's some that they showed that didn't even get around to getting made.
Right.
Which is unfortunate. But there's you know, I'm a fan of like kind of obscure and bizarre stuff. So, you know, every now and then I'm like, you know, I don't even like Kiss, but I want Kiss action. Just really good Kiss action figures, because there's never been really good ones. And, you know, there's the retro ones out, and there's the, you know, the Mold McFarlane stuff. But a nice Kiss meets the Phantom Park line, Phantom of the Park line, with like a big buildable roller coaster. That'd be a way to go.
He goes with Kiss. Back to the Future is on everybody's minds.
Yeah.
You guys have Back to the Future. But he's like, you know, I like Kiss. Even though I don't like Kiss, I'm going to go with Kiss. Well, I would love to see you guys, like I just said, I would love to see you guys tackle Back to the Future. I know that's a dream line for a lot of people, and it's a big mess when it comes to likenesses and everything. But I think you guys, and my sons and I have talked about this too, we think you guys would kill it at Big Trouble Little China and Back to the Future.
So, Big Trouble Little China would be pretty great.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
We would really thoroughly enjoy that if you tackled it.
I'm going to throw in my vote for Mad Max also, though, since you mentioned it, so...
It's definitely one that we've asked about.
Yeah.
You know, that, and I know Chuck always says Blade Runner is another big one.
Oh,
that'd
be great
too. If you can get that, so.
Yeah.
You know, but these are licenses that even when there's new stuff, you know, the old stuff is still tied up or, you know, owned by too many people, or it's just very complicated.
Right.
And again, the likeness of rights are not always there, so you'd have to negotiate them separately.
Right.
Which makes it problematic. Not impossible, but problematic.
Zach, I know we've had you on here a long time. We didn't get to cover everything that we wanted to talk about, but because it was just so much fun talking to you, and I like to hear all the intricacies that you can bring to the table. We would love to have you on again. We're not putting you on the spot right now, but just putting it out there.
Yeah.
We would love to have you on again to talk about the rest of the stuff we didn't get to cover here, but we really appreciate your time, and I hope that this was fun for you, too.
It was. Anytime. Let's do it again.
That's excellent. Awesome. Well, we've kept everybody on for maybe our longest episode yet, so if you stuck through it all, we really appreciate it. So this is Mike and Zach and James signing off from Action Features.